This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, great. We're ready to go. Welcome to the December 2015 Citizens Climate Lobby International Conference Call. This is Madeline Pera, CCL's Program Director. So it's true, you are not hearing Mark Reynolds' voice today. He's out of the country, and I'm trusting that he's having a great time. Knowing him, he's probably listening in from somewhere. So hi, Mark. I'll be introducing our speaker in a moment, but first let me just check. Admiral Titley, are you there and not muted, I hope?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me there, Madeline?
I can hear you. Great.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. All right.
Okay, I'm going to go back to mute then.
Okay. All right. So before Admiral Titley addresses us a little bit, what I'd like to do is welcome our new groups that got started in November. So we had Houston, Northeast, Atascocita, and Houston, West Katy, so congratulations, Houston, on two new chapters, Morgantown, West Virginia, Platteville, Wisconsin, two groups in Wyoming, Laramie and Cheyenne, Amador Calaveras, California, Olympia, Washington, Pinellas County, Florida, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Those were the new groups in the U.S. Plus in Canada, we have a new group in the town of London and a group in Barawa, Australia. Forgive me if I didn't say that right. This weekend, we also have group start workshops taking place in Louisville, Kentucky and Montrose, Colorado. So welcome, everybody. We are so glad to have you. By the end of the year, we will have, drum roll, 310 groups. So remember also that this is the last time we'll be having our international conference call on the first Saturday of the month. From now on, the call will be on the second Saturday of the month every month. And what we do on these calls is educate ourselves, practice, and focus on concrete actions. Our guest speakers are a key part of our ongoing education, so I am really delighted today that we have retired Rear Admiral David Titley with us. Before we hear from you, Admiral Titley, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about the people listening to the call. These are people who make big things happen in the world. For example, the daily blogs coming in from our people in Paris are just utterly inspiring. And our volunteers are not people who sit on the sidelines and then hope that somebody else will take action. They're just extremely creative and persistent people. In fact, we recently figured out that they're so persistent that on any given day, CCL volunteers meet with 3 elected representatives or their staff, publish 8 pieces of media, engage in 5 outreach events, and deliver 36 letters to Congress. So that's every day, and I call that teamwork. So now I would like to introduce Admiral Titley to those of you on the call. Admiral David Titley is a professor of practice in meteorology at Pennsylvania State University and the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. He was the chief operating officer for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration from 2012 to 13. And before assuming these positions, he was a rear admiral and the chief oceanographer of the U.S. Navy, which he served for 32 years. While serving in the Pentagon, Dr. Titley initiated and led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change. That's an incredible resume. I'm very grateful for all you've been doing. And I'm also very pleased to tell everybody on the call that Dr. Titley has recently joined CCL's advisory board. So, Admiral Titley, I would like to ask you to start out by telling us about the Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. I looked it up online a couple days ago, and the vision and mission statement are really intriguing. The vision says, create the knowledge, training, and solutions to enable the optimal outcome for every decision where weather and climate matter. And the mission says, to advance the science of exploiting environmental opportunities and understanding environmental impacts to manage risk. Now, I'd really like to know more about what this means in practice. Like, who are you working with, and what kinds of situations are you addressing? And have you found that talking about climate in this way opens some doors where more traditional approaches don't succeed? So if you'd start there, and then also tell us about climate and national security, that'd be terrific.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Madeline, and thank you, everybody, for listening in today and joining the conference. It's really quite amazing when you just listen to everybody who's online and around the country and literally around the world. Shout out to Australia. I was just down in Canberra, actually working with some of my Australian friends on climate and security about 10 days ago. So if I look at the center, this is, I guess, what somebody would call my day job that I'm supposed to be doing, is we are interested in how do you really use all of the weather data, all of the weather models. I'm a meteorologist by nature, by training. My wife figured out after the very first date that weather was not a subject of casual conversation for me. And what one of the things that we see nowadays in the weather community is there is so much information. We have gone from maybe 30 years ago, we had nowhere near enough information, to now, I would say, if not too much, that one of the real challenges is, so how do you use it all? How do you use it to make better decisions for your business, if you're running a local government, if you run emergency services, if you're running, let's say, a sporting venue? How do you manage risk? And there's a lot of work still to be done in that, so that's what we're trying to do. So the center here is pretty new. I'm the founding director, and it was kind of like me and hang up a shingle and go figure out what to do. We have been able to work with the U.S. intelligence community. I would call it predictive forensics. How do you see risk in advance? It's always easy to see, or usually easy to see when looking backwards. Not so easy to see in advance. And how do you know that and not fool yourself in the process? It's also really easy to make up of a bunch of stuff that worked well in the past but may not work in the future. So that's challenging. We have worked with some private sector firms all the way from allergy companies or big pharma companies, I would say, working some allergy index. You know, if you think about, everybody kind of on the nightly news or even on your phone, you can call up and you can look at what the radar is, at least across the United States and across many countries in the world. Imagine if that was pollen forecasts, allergy forecasts, and maybe it's different types of pollen, and maybe person A is affected by oak and person B is affected by birch. Wouldn't it be cool if you had an app on your phone that could actually learn all that stuff and figure that out? So we're working with some companies on that. We're working with some startup companies on how do you fundamentally observe the Earth differently? How do you put up a whole bunch of very cheap satellites, at least cheap by comparison to what we traditionally do? But then, more importantly even, how do you best use that data to come up with better understanding of future possibilities of the weather, and then how do you manage that risk? So all of that, if it sounds kind of technical and really nonpartisan, may or may not be boring depending on your outlook on life. But these are ways in which, you know, if you can do it for weather, you frankly just kind of keep extending that, and then you're doing it for climate. And it, to some degree, can avoid a lot of the, say, polarization and partisanship that's come over on the climate side. So it's just kind of a pragmatic way of looking at things. So I'm happy if there is Q&A. I mean, I can talk more about that. But unfortunately, I don't spend a ton of time on doing that stuff because I seem to get consumed in the climate stuff rather instead. So I think Mark, and I don't know if Mark's online, but if you are, hello. He'd asked me to talk about a little bit on the security, and he'd asked for some specific things, so I'll just go through them. So I think Mark had asked me to talk about the what's called the Department of Defense Quadrennial Defense Review. And, you know, and being in the government, you know, we can't have any kind of like simple-minded or simple-named things, so we have to have really big words. But all it means is every 4 years you're supposed to go and kind of take an overarching look at where the defense posture of the United States is and where you think it should go. So they're done, as I said, every 4 years. So 2014 was the last one that was done, and it was the second Quadrennial Defense Review, or QDR, that actually talked about climate change as one of, not the only, but one of the considerations the Department of Defense should have. So, I mean, overall, what the QDR says is we should protect the homeland, we should build security from a global perspective, and if we have to go into combat, we should project power and win decisively. And I think, you know, most Americans at least would agree with that. You don't You don't go into combat to try to win second place. So if you step it down, what the QDR says about climate change is that it increases risk of conflict and instability overseas. It impacts our Department of Defense operations, our people, installations. And finally, it impacts the stability, development, and human security in other nations. And this really kind of gets to what climate change is. It has a range of direct impacts, such as on bases and on training ranges, but then it has a set of indirect impacts as we change both the environment, like up in the Arctic, all the ice comes out in the summertime, and that has huge changes. All the way to an increase in geostrategic risks. Now, Mark asked me to talk about the QDR, and that's sort of in, you know, in 30 seconds what it is. There are two other documents that you can either look up on the web. These are all out on the web, or just listen to for about a minute or two, because I think they're probably as important as the Quadrennial Defense Review. So later in 2014, the Department of Defense put out what they call their Climate Change Adaptation Roadmap. And again, it's a thick document, but if you can sort of boil it down to four key points, basically the DOD said we're going to identify and assess climate change impacts. That's pretty important because you don't want to go work on the wrong stuff. So identify and assess climate change impacts. The second one is really think about climate change considerations across the entire range or the full range of department missions and activities. That means this is everybody's job. You know, you don't just sort of put it off in the corner with the guy who sort of looks like a scientist. But this is everybody's part of their day job, or at least it's supposed to be. Finally, number three is collaboration. Madeline mentioned on the beginning, it's a team. And that's absolutely true. The way the Department of Defense looks at this, it's a team both within other federal agencies and local and regional stakeholders within the United States. It's teamwork within our partners and allies overseas as well. And again, it's why even though I've been retired, I still end up in Australia and Norway and Britain and places like that working with like-minded defense colleagues on this common challenge. And then finally, the Department of Defense actually has a climate change officer designated, and I think that was part of an executive order. You had to do that. Now, finally, and I won't go through in a ton of detail on this, but the geographic commanders, basically these are the admirals and generals, the four stars, who really control the operating United States forces around the world. They put out a report just about 2 months ago. They talked about climate change, and this was a they were looking at persistently recurring conditions, you know, sort of the chronic flooding and drought, higher temperatures, increasing strain on fragile states. And then you add to that more frequent and or more severe extreme weather events. So, you know, it's already not great, and then you get a really big push that can either cause a big surge in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And then finally, the sea level rise and temperature changes, the seas coming up are, you know, long term, it's a big, big deal. And then Arctic. And again, we could talk a whole afternoon about Arctic, but I don't have the time right now. So those are kind of what we are looking at. If I have time, Madeline, I'd like to talk just a little bit about threat multiplier because it's been in the news so much. It came up in the Democratic debate with Senator Sanders. Prince Charles has chimed in, as has Bill Nye, the science guy. And there's a lot of kind of, not really great information floating around by what that means. So I'm just going to kind of go through this, and it came up really within the context of Syria and ISIS, and obviously post-Paris bombings especially, and possibly even post-the tragedy in San Bernardino here. You know, a lot of people are saying, why are you even talking about climate and security? We should just be going after those ISIS guys. And others are saying that climate caused Syria. It caused ISIS. And I would say both of those are not the way to look at this. Climate and climate change is one of. It is one of the links in the chain that got us to Syria. But it was also combined with decades of really bad management of both resources and people by the president of Syria, by a guy named Assad. It was also some completely non-climate event issues, such as the Iraq War, which put almost 1 million refugees into Syria. And again, it's Assad. He takes terrible care of people, whether they're his or others. But then when you added on to that, you had a really bad drought a few years ago, which has a pretty big climate fingerprint on it. So yes, it's a desert. Yes, it's the Eastern Mediterranean, but it's got even worse. And that then basically, again, combined with Sadat's bad policies, I mean, he actually tried to make the whole Syria self-sufficient in food. He did it for a very short time, but he did it by basically draining the rivers and using up all the groundwater. So then when you get a worse drought that he hadn't really anticipated, and that one kind of related to climate change, there's no plan B. The farmers had nothing but dust and dirt. So they then also move into the cities that, remember, already have 1 million refugees from the Iraq War, and the place collapses. And now you have conditions very ripe for charismatic and extremist terrorist groups to recruit from and to organize. And one of the things that came out of that is this organization we now call ISIS. So was climate part of it? Yes, it was part of it. Would climate by itself have caused ISIS? No. But should we ignore climate? Absolutely not. So I hope that helps, because there's been so much bad info on that. And it's really, really hard to put into 140 characters you can send out on Twitter, you know, or talking to that crazy uncle at the Christmas, dinner table there about this stuff. But I did put out a tweet on this maybe 2 weeks ago, and I said the false dichotomy of terror versus climate. Terror is a threat, and climate is a risk that increases multiple threats. So a threat, you know, if somebody wants to do something bad to you, that's part of what a threat is. A risk, you know, climate doesn't care. It doesn't think. It's not trying to create ISIS or trying to kill us. But what the climate is doing is it's changing, and we know why, because we're changing it, because we're putting the greenhouse gases in. So I've told people, ice doesn't vote Republican or vote Democrat. The ice is just going to melt. So the climate is a risk that makes the threats worse, and that's really what the threat multiplier is. The one other thing I'm going to say here, I was asked to, you know, how this goes when I speak to Congress, and you all can tune in there because I get the opportunity, I guess you would call it that, of testifying before Senator Cruz this coming Tuesday afternoon. The title of the hearing is called Data or Dogma, so I think you kind of see where this is going. There will be three other scientists. I would argue they are probably not mainstream climate scientists that will be testifying with me, so wish me luck, and we'll see what kind of reception we get. I'm not really expecting to change Senator Cruz's mind, but maybe some others who will listen might be able to have some second thoughts there. So I think if I understood it right from Mark that my time is just about up here. So let me stop here, Madeline, and ask you what you would like to do next. I don't know if you guys do Q&A or if you want me to speak about a few other things. I want to give a shout out if they're online to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Citizens Climate Lobby. I was just there two nights ago, had a great meeting at Franklin and Marshall. So Jerry and everybody who organized that, thank you.
That was really helpful, Admiral Titley. And the folks in Lancaster were telling us what a great job and what a great speaker you were. So they were giving a shout out to you earlier in the week.
Thanks.
And I think that's particularly helpful where you were talking about Syria and giving us some language for how to accurately talk about threats and risks. So thank you.
Great.
We do have just a little bit of time left. I'm wondering, and I love that you're going to be talking with Senator Cruz and others.
I'm glad one of us is loving that.
Well, Perhaps you will too, and they will. You never know. And that's the spirit in which we operate. Do you get many opportunities to talk with members of Congress? Do you have a sense that the security aspect of climate change resonates with them? What's your sense there?
I get to talk to members from time to time. I talk to staffers probably a good deal more than the actual members. My assessment is most right-of-center politicians do, in fact, understand the science. Some are really beholden to very, very strong views that are not likely to change for a variety of reasons. But there are many who I think are not completely locked in, but they understand the politics at least as well as the climate, and probably a lot better because they are, you know, they didn't get to where they are by accident. So, I mean, I'm sure you've had Bob Inglis on these phone calls, and I think Bob's on the advisory board, and I've, in fact, I first ran into him through CCL. You know, and you talk to Congressman Inglis, and, you know, and it's a very, you know, it's a very interesting story of, you know, just even sort of without sort of preparation of the voters kind of even hinting that you might want to engage on this issue, and all of a sudden you find yourself out of a job. So I ask sometimes when I'm talking to my left of center, my environmental friends, I just ask them for a quick show of hands who wants to be fired on Tuesday. And surprisingly enough, nobody raises their hand. And I said, you know, to some degree, not all, but to some degree, this is what some of the right-of-center politicians are dealing with. You can either ignore this issue, kind of slow-roll this issue, hope it goes away, and keep your job. Or if you roll it out the wrong way, you know, the next thing you know is you're going to be both getting Climate Hero Awards and collecting an unemployment paycheck. Because, you know, they don't want to be the next Bob Inglis. So how do we do this? How do we build enough support either in districts so this is at least a topic that can be talked about without it being a firing offense? But also, are there different ways to frame this so that we get to the end, the objective? Basically, how do you decarbonize the energy system? And how do you talk about that in a way that that maybe hasn't been talked about before? So things like, you know, this initiative we just heard about from Bill Gates in Paris there, or are there other initiatives? Where is nuclear in this? How do we make sure that the U.S. and U.S. cities, U.S. companies, you know, lead the 21st energy transition and revolution, and we'll transition. I mean, there's no doubt that we're going to transition, but we can either do it quickly, which would be better, or slowly, which would be a lot worse, and we can either lead it from San Francisco and Seattle and Detroit and Charlotte and Boston, or we can lead it from Beijing and Shanghai and Qingdao. You know, I'd argue that I'd prefer to see the former. So how do we make that happen? And, you know, and I can have that conversation pretty much without even using the C word. So, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, we lock into the science. I think almost, you know, everybody knows this really is not about the science. It has nothing to do with the science, in fact. This is about policy, and it's about risk management, and it's about how do we make sure that we position ourselves in this country for the 21st century in a way that will benefit not only us, but the world, and that our children, and especially our grandchildren, do not inherit a world that, frankly, would have a tremendously difficult time supporting the numbers of people and the kind of civilization that we have grown up to expect and desire.
That's excellent. Yeah, we did see a change in our June lobbying away from the science being brought up and much more focus on solutions.
Good. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we thought so too. I wanted to go back to Syria for just a moment and focus on the refugee part of it. and the migrant. How do you look at that, and how do you talk about that in this context?
I mean, I think these are you know, kind of the issues, and we pointed to this as saying, you know, there is a component, a thread of this that is climate related. But as probably you know, and I'll bet many of the CCL members know, there's actually no such thing right now as a climate refugee. That doesn't exist under international law. You know, refugee has a fairly specific meaning. It's like you were oppressed in your home because of political circumstances and all this kind of stuff. And right now, climate doesn't fit in that. So, you know, not to make this a paid political announcement, but one of my hats is I'm an adjunct fellow at a think tank in Washington, D.C. called the Center for New American Security. And this coming Friday morning, we're actually going to run a workshop with three former assistant secretaries of defense on just this issue of, you know, regardless of what comes out of this coming week in Paris, the climate will continue to change for decades to come, at least. We're going to probably have to get a handle around what do we mean, what do we do with climate refugees? Can we call them that? But even more importantly, so what should we do? So I'm trying to find some smart people to help think through this. I think it's going to be one of the issues of the early and mid-21st century, and we really, really haven't even started thinking about it yet.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about actually is Paris, because that's all on our minds this week. What's your perspective on how things are going there?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I read the blogs and Twitters and you know, and sort of the moment-by-moment feedback. It's almost like watching temperatures, you know, minute by minute, and, you know, 1 minute it goes down and 1 minute it goes up. And, you know, so you sort of need to step back. I think in general terms, you know, if I think back to, like, World War One, there was a guy who ran the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, called Admiral Jellicoe, Lord Jellicoe. And he was termed as the only person that could lose World War One in an afternoon. Basically, if he went out to fought the German High Fleet, and if he lost, that would have ended the war. But nothing Jellicoe could do would actually win the war. And to some degree, Paris sort of looks like that to me. You know, if it really falls apart, that would be very, very bad, and we could kind of lose tremendous momentum. But I'm not sure that anything coming out of Paris, you know, we're not going to wake up, you know, in 8 days from now and say, oh, great, now we solved the climate problem, now let's go on to something else. But without serious work and, you know, good faith negotiations, whether it's on INDCs or similar type things, you know, there's a lot to lose. But I will be very, very surprised if we have, you know, we're all doing high fives here in a week from Monday because we've solved the climate issue.
Yeah. In a way, what that says is after Paris, it's still on us to keep doing what we do.
Yeah, it's yeah. You know, Paris is, I would say, necessary but not sufficient.
Perfect. Well, we do need to stop here. And this has been really helpful, and I thank you so much for taking the time on Saturday to talk with us. And really also for all the things you're doing, which I have a feeling we just heard a little bit of and that there's probably a lot more you could have said. but thank you so much.
Okay.
If you have a little time, you're welcome to stay on the call and catch the last 10 or 15 minutes
okay.
where we're updating what we're doing. But I know that time can be very precious.
All right. Thanks, Madeline. If I could just ask you a very quick question. Do you know on the average about how many – I mean, it just sounded like dozens and dozens and dozens of people coming in. Do you know how many – either individual phone lines or a rough number of people that are on this? Because I think this is
Oh, I love that you asked that. So people call in as part of a group meeting,
mm-hmm.
and anywhere from, I would guess, around 150 groups are calling in, and then a number
okay.
will be listening to it later. So if you assume,
okay.
You know, if you assume around five, and it's anywhere from two people in the room to 30 people in the room.
I heard 30,
so,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so we're talking
Wonderful.
Quite a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just tremendous. So, I mean, I really want to thank everybody who is listening for what you're doing, because I am, you know, I sometimes, if you've heard my talk, you know, I go through a stuff on climate, and then I ask, do I believe in climate change? Everybody raises their hand, and I say, oh, actually, I don't. You see, I shouldn't tell you this, because if you come to, you know, if you ask me to speak to your chapters, you now know the trick. But I'm convinced by the evidence. But a belief I have is that this will be in large part solved because we, the citizens, demand a solution. I don't think Congress will lead, but I think they can be led. And the work you're doing is, in fact, creating that space, especially on the center and center right, that will allow politicians to get beyond some of the silliness that we've, you know, endured for 15 years or so, and then have a debate as to, you know, a policy debate as to what we're going to do. So I think the work that CCL does is just amazingly important, because without that perception of safe space in the voters, then I don't know that we really move ahead. So I think, you know, CCL and the work everybody on this phone does is really, this is way more important, frankly, than anything we're going to do in the science community. It just is. This is how we're going to solve this.
Well, thank you so much. I think of it as a team, what you're doing and what we're doing, so we'll all keep doing it.
It's Lynnae. Madeline, I'll jump in and do my report right now if you'd like. Sure. So I am going to report on how our Giving Tuesday went. We had an incredible Giving Tuesday. As you might have noticed, we started off with a $25,000 challenge grant. It grew to $50,000 when another donor wanted to add to the matching fund. Then we had a $30,000 addition from three family members who are all involved with our work, bringing our matching grant total to $80,000. So we had amazing momentum before Giving Tuesday even began. But that meant we had to bring in a full $80,000 to match our challenge grants. And to tell you the truth, I was a little nervous when I woke up on Giving Tuesday. Well, we hit $80,000 by 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. Incredible. Then that total kept growing throughout the day and evening to a final of $181,628. Can you believe it? I can't. And then when you add in the $80,000 challenge grant, we had a total of $261,628 brought in from Giving Tuesday. It taught me all over again that CCL volunteers will blow right through whatever challenge they take on. Before I go, I want to share that our year-end appeal will go through December 31st. If you haven't yet had a chance to donate in support of our work, or if you'd like to ask friends or family to donate before year-end, all you have to do is go to citizensclimate.org/give and click on the donate button. That's citizensclimate.org/give. So thank you, everyone, for your incredibly generous support and for your amazing outreach to friends and family. What you've reminded me of, once again, is you should never, ever underestimate the tenacity and generosity of a CCL volunteer. Madeline, are you there?
Yes, okay. I am. Can you guys hear me? And is this better?
Yeah, that's much better. That's much better.
Okay. Speaking of teamwork, my neighbors have given me a different and better phone. It landed in my hand. And, Lynnae,
awesome.
Thank you. That,
yep.
You know, I was going to save that for last because it is so incredibly juicy. But thank you. I'm glad everybody got to hear that.
Sure.
All right. Let me see where I am now. I was on Joe. So let me tell you what Joe had to say from Paris. He sent a report, and it's just been fantastic what's been going on in Paris there. So here's what Joe said. He said that in the first 3 days of the conference last week, that CCL participated in an unprecedented breakthrough for carbon pricing, including real support for fee and dividend, at the launch of something called the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. And our team launched the Citizens Climate Engagement Network, which is a first-of-its-kind global platform for expanding civic participation in global negotiations, and it's rooted in CCL's methodology. So So the Citizens Climate Engagement Network is going to include both an advisory coalition and a global team of collaborators. Its mission will be to host local meetings, find common ground, design new and innovative solutions, and bring local genius into the UN process. And UNICEF is the first UN institution to join the advisory coalition. And all the other partners include the People and Planet Project and the Global Challenges Action Network. So that's a huge step forward for citizen engagement in the international policy process. But Joe goes on, he says, let's take a minute to recognize what a partnership of world leaders has done to honor the kind of work that you do. Our volunteers across Canada had a special victory when their new prime minister signed up for the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. And that coalition is a breakthrough up for carbon pricing and inclusive policymaking in four particular ways. So one, the mission is to build carbon pricing into national climate plans by 2020. Two, CCL and other groups sit at the same table as governments, intergovernment agencies, and businesses, including major oil companies. And at that table, all of the partners are equal. That was three. And four, for the first time, a global policymaking body endorses attributes of fee and dividend, including fiscal dividends, equitable revenue return, economy-wide coverage, and administrative simplicity and efficiency. So while the Paris negotiated agreement may or may not include a mandate to price carbon, there is now an official action platform for implementation of the Paris Agreement and whose mission is to price carbon everywhere. So that's the end of Joe's report. He tells me that there are 40 volunteers there in Paris, and the team there would like you, if you want, to go to pathwaytoparis.org/thank you and share some words of gratitude, because this is CCL, some words of gratitude to world leaders who are there. They'd also like you to visit their Facebook page and like it. And I encourage you to check out citizensvoice.tv. I listened to some of the videos posted there this morning, and it made me feel like I was there with them. I was so proud of them. All those links that I just mentioned have been posted this morning on the homepage of CCL Community, so you can go get them there. I was also really excited to hear that Elon Musk is over in Paris and calling for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. That just blows my mind. So, I had this thought once that maybe Joe Robertson wouldn't know what to do with himself after Paris is over. He's worked so long and hard to inject carbon pricing into the discussions. And not only has he succeeded beyond our dreams, but I think he's given hope and support to many world leaders and brought so many citizen voices into the process. So, Joe, if you're listening from Paris, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who has been and is now working with you. There's too many of you to name, but we're so, so grateful for what you're doing. And, Joe, we know Paris is a beginning and not an end, so I'm sure you'll have plenty to do next year. Okay, so I want to talk just briefly about our endorser project. The tech department is putting the finishing touches on a new system for tracking endorsements. They're eager to share it with you this week on Thursday as the next CCL University webinar. And our volunteers have clearly been busy, you guys, contacting organizations and community leaders, because Peter Brin tells me that you've collectively gathered over 200 endorsements since we started this program. So fantastic. Thank you, everybody. Amy Bennett, who keeps tabs on our field reports and statistics, tells me that we added 2,500 new supporters in December, and we're up to 23,500 now. So keep that up, folks. And just remember that those supporters are in 434 out of 435 congressional districts. And I'm fully expecting that one of you is going to sign up a supporter in northern Mississippi before the end of the year, giving us a supporter in every single congressional district in the U.S. So don't let me down on that. First, a supporter in every district, and then we turn that into a group in every district. All right, we had our November Lobby Day, and we surpassed our goals. We had 140 volunteers and held 172 lobby meetings. 28 of those were face-to-face, which was fantastic, and we had a good turnout by congressional offices at our briefings later that week, with equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. It's always a success when we get members of both U.S. political parties in the same room hearing about solutions to climate change. We also had two successful regional conferences in November in Minnesota and New Hampshire. Congratulations to the folks who organized those. One last piece of news from November that I just want to share comes from the teens in the CCL Club at Milburn High School in New Jersey, who lobbied with us in D.C. last summer. The CCL chapter that they work with was having trouble getting an in-district meeting with their congressperson, and their requests were just going nowhere. But when the teens requested a meeting, not only did they get a face-to-face meeting, which they graciously allowed some of the adult CCLers to attend, but the meeting lasted for over an hour, and the congressman wanted to talk to the students again after the Paris talks. So our youth are brilliant and unstoppable. Let's all go get some more of them. Okay, so last thing is the actions for December. In the U.S., they are 1, write letters to the editor about the Paris Climate Conference. 2, write letters to members of Congress expressing support for a global climate agreement and the need for U.S. leadership going forward. The Canadian actions are, 1, participate in the Canadian version of the CCL endorsement project, and 2, ask friends to donate to Citizens Climate Lobby Canada. Speaking of Canada, last weekend, the editors of the Toronto Sun, Canada's largest conservative paper, referred to carbon fee and dividend as, quote, the best model, unquote, in a comment that they made underneath Kathy Orlando's letter to the editor. But my favorite quote of the week had to be this one from Paris. The German environment minister said, carbon pricing is the most tasty piece of the cake of transformative climate solutions, unquote. So I'm thinking about baking a cake for my next lobby meeting. Okay, I'm going to unmute all of you now so that you can say goodbye. Let's ride that wave of the Paris talks. So let's keep it going in the new year. Thanks, you guys. Hold on while I unmute.